a poem. You'll know this poem. It's about a wasp. A severed wasp once drank the juice of a ripe pear upon a plate, and one did idly meditate, what was the use? Yet, round about us, spent and done, with hands already growing cold, we see half men still grasping gold, its use is gone. Do you get that? And we've all had that experience of the unwelcome guest at the picnic, or when you're having your tea, or you're sitting in the well, a wasp. And if you've seen that wonderful film, What We Did on Our Holiday, you'll remember the Scottish lady trying to kill the wasp in the window. And at our picnic, and when we get the wasp, somebody gets the rolled up newspaper and swats it and misses, and you swat and you miss, and you swat and you miss, and you swat and you miss. And before very long, the poor old wasp is exhausted and gives up the ghost, but it's somewhere under the settee. And you don't know whether it's dead or not, so you've got to find it, and then you've got to give it the death blow. Or some kind person comes and takes it in a piece of tissue and throws it outside, and 5 minutes later, it's in again. You've got to deal with it, or else it'll come back. And you know, an injured wasp, or even half a wasp, provided it's the bottom half, can give your heel a nasty sting. Well, I want to tell you a little thing from my own experience. I was told by a preacher in the past, never preach from your own experience. Well, I didn't like him, so I'm going to preach from my experience. When I was 26 years old, I had my tonsils out. Now, when you're 26, that's quite a serious operation. And I was in hospital for about 5 days, and then they sent me home, and 24 hours later, I was back in hospital with secondary hemorrhaging. It was an interesting time in hospital. I was in, it was in Beverley, Yorkshire. The ward was a wooden hut with about 10 men in there and two pot-bellied stoves that were red hot at night. And it was really interesting time. But I recall that the surgeon who was going to do the operation came round to speak to his various patients just before the operation. And he came to my bed and had a little chat. And while we were chatting, he looked at my bedside table where there was an ashtray with some fag ends in the ashtray. And he said, have you been smoking? Now, the amazing thing is, when you think back to the mid-1960s, I was in hospital and men were smoking in bed in hospital in those days. And that was considered to be all right. But he didn't think it was all right. He said, have you any idea the damage that that poison is doing to your lungs, your bloodstream, your chest, your throat, your mouth, your brain? He said, I've half a mind not to do this operation. He said, I want you to promise me faithfully that you will give up smoking. So I said, yes, I will. But actually, it was my mouth saying it, not my heart. I had the operation, and a month later I started to smoke again because I hadn't dealt it the death blow. See? Actually, having my tonsils out at 26 was also quite interesting because I'd already had them out when I was 7. Yeah. And I said to the doctor, what's going on? I've already had my tonsils out. And he said, well, what happens is that the first surgeon probably didn't remove all the tissue. There would be a little bit left in, and it's grown again. You see, the first surgeon didn't give it what I'm going to call the death blow. And it grew again. Well, I just want to introduce you to one or two. Actually, the Bible is full of examples of that. That is, where it wasn't dealt the death blow. The wasp, the tonsils, the smoking. Actually, for me, while I just mention it, the same thing happened to me with drinking. I used to drink quite a lot. I was never an alcoholic. Mary thought I was getting on that way, but I never was. And she was praying, Lord, and it started to. And there came a time when I gave up drinking, and then I started again, gave it up and started again. And there came a time when I said, this is ridiculous. I drink 2 or 3 glasses of wine on a night. The next day I feel abnormal right up till dinner time. It's time I did something about this. So on the 1st of June 2009, I said, no more. I gave it the death blow. And I haven't had any since. Apart from 2 occasions when I took communion at Durham Cathedral and they served real wine. You know, so... No, it wasn't Durham, it was somewhere else, because they don't give you the wine, do they? Anyway, wherever it was. See what happened? I didn't deal it the death blow. My heart wasn't in it. I said, I'm going to give up, but it was just my mouth. Anyway, I want to read you this bit out of 1 Samuel, chapter 15. Now, some of you will be very familiar with this event, and some of you won't. So if you're not reading the Old Testament, you'll not be familiar with this. Let me just give you an outline of the background. The people of Israel in the land that God had promised to them as an eternal inheritance, they just arrived there years ago, and I don't know how many years, but they said to Samuel, who was the head lad at the time, we want a king. And Samuel, or God said through Samuel, that wouldn't be a good idea. But the people said, we want a king. Samuel said, no. The people said, we've got a better idea than that. We want a king. So eventually God said, give them a king. So they got Saul. And King Saul was the first king of Israel, and he was a dud. And he was a dud for this reason. They were surrounded by enemies then, as they are now. And one of those enemies was a tribe called the Amalekites. Now, if you're interested, if you're into the Old Testament, which I am, if you read about Amalek, then you'll understand why the Amalekites were enemies of Israel. They caused all kinds of trouble, raiding over the border, raping and pillaging, you know, all that stuff that the invaders do. And they were fed up of them, and God was fed up of them. And God eventually said to Saul, I want you to go and deal with those Amalekites, good and proper, once and for all. So Saul got the army together, and off they went. And this is where it is. It's in 1 Corinthians. It's 1 Corinthians. It's in 1 Samuel chapter 15. So Saul summoned the men and mustered them at Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men from Judah. Saul went to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the ravine. Then he said to the Kenites, go away, leave the Amalekites so that I do not destroy you along with them. For you showed kindness to us and the Israelites when they came up out of Egypt. So the Kenites moved away from Amalek. Now, then Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way from Havilah to Shur to the east of Egypt. he took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and all his people, he totally destroyed. I should say, by the way, before I go any further, that God told Saul, destroy them all. All of them. Kill them all. Men, women, children. And the old man on the Zimmer frame, kill him. The old lady sitting knitting by the fireside, kill her. The baby at the breast, kill it. And the mother. You know, and I thought, oh, I don't really don't like the idea at all of this. And not only that, but also all the flocks, all the herds, all the camels, all the donkeys, the dogs, the cats, the budgie, everything. Wipe them out. Wipe them out. I didn't like that a bit, to be honest. And I still don't understand all of God's ways. But then on Monday, I was reading this. This is in the book of Ecclesiastes, where I'm reading at the moment. Funny book, is Ecclesiastes, I tell you. But it says this, obey the king's command, I say, because you took an oath before God. Do not be in a hurry to leave the king's presence. Do not stand up for a bad cause, for he will do whatever he pleases. Since the king's word is supreme, who can say to him, what are you doing? And when I read that about wiping out the Amalekites, even the babies, even, you know, everybody, I was thinking about God. I was thinking, what are you doing? But God is sovereign. Anyway, to carry on. So he took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and all his people he totally destroyed with the sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag, and the best of the sheep and the cattle, the fat calves and the lamb, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak they totally destroyed. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, I am grieved that I have made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions. Samuel was troubled, and he cried out to the Lord all that night. Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul, but he was told Saul has gone to Carmel. There he has set up a monument in his own honor and has turned and gone down to Gilgal. When Samuel reached him, Saul said, the Lord bless you. I have carried out the Lord's instructions. Now, this bit I think is really funny. You know, it's not funny, but it is. But Samuel cried, what then is this bleating of sheep I hear? What is this lowing of cattle that I hear? Saul answered, the soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and the cattle to sacrifice to the Lord, your God. But we totally destroyed the rest. Stop, Samuel said to Saul. Let me tell you what the Lord told me last night. Samuel said, although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission saying, go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites. Make war on them until you have wiped them out. Why then did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord? But I did obey the Lord, Saul said. I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag alive, their king. The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal. You see what he's saying? I did kill them all, except I kept Agag the king alive, and the best of the what are you talking about? You can't say you killed them all and yet you saved the king. Well, Samuel was furious. And actually, in this case, Samuel is echoing the way God felt. So when you read the Old Testament, you'll find that two things God is totally intolerant of. They actually boil down to the same thing. One is disobedience, and one is idolatry. And God said, do this, and Saul said, I've got a better idea. And it's idolatry, because he was setting himself up and saying, I know better than God. Saul was on the throne, not God. So God was furious. And Samuel echoes God's fury. And Samuel said, bring him to me. Who? Agag. Bring him here. And Agag came all smarmy and smirking. And it says that Samuel took a sword and killed Agag himself. This is Samuel, the holy man. You know, the good guy. And he's in the old Bible, in the Bible that I first read this in, it said that he hacked him to pieces before the Lord. And that's sort of a picture itself. That if Saul wasn't going to do the job properly, then God would do it for him through Samuel. Well, I thought about this, and I thought about if Saul had done the job properly in the first place, then God wouldn't have needed to intervene and so on. But now I just want to take you to the book of Esther. If you've ever read the book of Esther, hey? Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's coming. Now we come to the book of Esther. Now this is, I don't know, maybe a couple of hundred years later. I don't know the history, but this is later. And again, Esther's a wonderful story, by the way. It's true. They're all true. It's a wonderful story. If you want to read a good story this afternoon after you've had your dinner, just before you nod off to sleep, just read the book of Esther. It's a great story and it's true. And the people of Israel are now exiled in a foreign land, probably, I don't know, Persia or somewhere that way on. And the king is a man called Xerxes. And there they are in exile, away from their land, and they've settled down and by an amazing sequence of events, a Jewish girl called Esther had become queen. But also in the court, there was a really, really bad man whose name was Haman. And Haman was like Hitler 3,000 years ago. He thought it would be a really good idea to wipe the Jews out altogether. Kill them all. And he came to the king with this idea. I don't know what was going on in the king's mind, but he said, okay, go ahead, do it. Kill the Jews. All of them. It's not surprising. It's the longest hatred in history. And everybody wants to kill the Jews. But they're on a loser there because they're not going to do it. And in fact, in this case, it didn't happen either. But the idea was there to wipe out the Jews. I just want to take one verse from the book of Esther. And if you're following, it's in chapter 3. But if you're not, just listen to see what's behind all this. It says, so the king, when Haman came along to the king and said, great idea, I've got a great idea, let's kill all the Jews. So the king took his signet ring from his finger, that's the symbol of authority, took the signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, and said, go and do it. And it didn't happen because another amazing sequence of events stopped it happening. But did you notice in that verse it said that Haman, the bad man who wanted to wipe out the Jews, he was the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. He was a descendant of that very man who Saul refused to put to death when he was told that that's what he should do. Something of the spirit of Agag had come down through the centuries and was now in Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. What a difference there would have been had Saul done the job properly in the first place, exactly as God had said. That wouldn't have happened. It was a moment of danger. But God is never going to allow that to happen. Do you get what I'm saying? The death blow is so important. Now, I know what you're thinking. Somebody is thinking, John, you're supposed to be preaching from Colossians. Well, I am preaching from Colossians. This is one book. You know, the message is the same. Written over what? 3,000 years? 40 different authors? 66 different books? Same message. So I am preaching from the book of Colossians. But let's just come to it to keep things right, shall we? The book of Colossians. It's in here somewhere. My bit is chapter 3. And I'm going to read the first 17 verses of chapter 3. And yet, when I come to the verse, you'll know why I've been rambling on about tonsils and wasps and Haman the Agagite. Colossians chapter 3. Since then you have been a... This is fantastic stuff, honestly. Read this stuff. It's absolutely wonderful. It's pure gold. Since then you have been raised with Christ. Set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above and not on earthly things, for you died and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. Wow! Come on! When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Bring it on. Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature. Sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. You used to walk in these ways, in the life you once lived, but now you must rid yourselves of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language. Do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. Here there is no Greek or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and in all. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, patience. Bear with each other and forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body, you were called to peace. And be thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom, and as you sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with gratitude in your hearts to God. And whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. What a great thing. But did you notice that? Put to death. There are certain things in our lives that need to be put to death. Certain things need the death blow. And there's a list of stuff there. And as I was reading through that list, I hope you were asking yourself the question, does that apply to me? Is that one of my things that needs to be put to death? And as we think about those things that I've just been reading from the Old Testament, who is the Agag in your life? My life too, that needs to be put to death. Now, all those things about sexual immorality and lying and anger and rage, you may say, well, you know, none of those really. But what about other things that need to be put to death? And I just jotted a few things down. I talked about smoking and drinking, my own experience. I was just relating my own experience, examples of things that had to be dealt the death blow. And instead of fiddling about and just saying it with my mouth and not doing it, it didn't happen until the time came. And you know, I gave up smoking 40-odd years ago, and through the big disasters of my life and little disasters too, I've never, ever thought that it would be a good idea to have a fag, you know, never. And the same with drinking, I don't miss it a bit. But there may be other habits, not those, that you've got, and you, only you and God know what they are. Other addictions, maybe. Or what about pornography? Is it something that needs the death blow? Finally, what about bearing a grudge against someone? What about unforgiveness? It needs a death blow. What about gossip? What about cliquishness? Cliques in the church are deadly because they create division. What about criticism? What about criticism of the leadership? Criticism of one another? What about bitterness? What about cynicism? What I'm saying is that each one of us, me, you, everyone, we need to say to God, what is it in my life that needs the death blow? Because there'll be one thing. I know what mine is. Do you know what yours is? To deal it the death blow. No fooling about, the death blow. There's a verse in the letter to the Hebrews, in chapter 12, where the apostle speaks of the sin which so easily entangles. He doesn't say a sin. He says, for you, Saul, there is an Agag. For you, for me, there is one thing, the sin, that so easily entangles, and it needs to be strangled to death, stamped on, the death blow. And when you've dealt with that one, there's another. And God deals with these things one at a time to deal the death blow to those things. Now, you may need some advice on that. You may need to talk to somebody about it. You may need to help with it. You may have a friend who is close enough for you to say, look, help me with this. You may just need to deal with it yourself. If you want somebody to pray with you, ask somebody. There are plenty of people who would do that. But what is that one thing that needs a death blow? because if you don't give it the death blow, it'll come back and bite you really hard in the bum sometime else.